Mr. Cheeseman, reel 19. You, at the end of the last tape, Mr. Cheeseman, we talked about the first class certificate of education that you were recommended to take. What was the outset of that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I feel that we were going a bit too fast, and I needed to. I think at this stage I need to fill in a few of the gaps that I've left out in my life with the service battalion. As I said, it was the technical officer who really advised me to get my general education up to standard if I was to be promoted and things like that. And it's on his recommendation that I start this correspondence course, because in a service battalion there was no such thing, well, it wasn't possible. So you can imagine the amount of time I had for myself, as it were, because apart from my normal military duties, I was studying quite a concentrated studying. And you say, well, surely, after all that discipline and what have you that you got in the army, how on earth do you fit that lot in? Well, you know, I did mention this, but I must mention again to emphasize it, that iron discipline of my training, where you were not allowed to even think for a moment for yourself, the usual old-fashioned army training. Here am I, almost a semi-civilian, because the regime in the tanks in those days was that of semi-civilian, if I can put it like that. I've got a photograph, I'm not going to describe, but I've got a photograph of our maneuvers with sitting on the ground reading a book and a ground sheet on my side, and a fella lying there snoozing in the afternoon. And this is our maneuvers. And you say, my goodness, he had an easy time there. But when I tell you that the fella that was lying next to me was my section sergeant, now you see that. We became more human. And so it wasn't a question of you're finishing your duties at 5 o'clock and then you've got to bone up this and clean up that and what have you. The rest of the night was your own. For instance, we never went on even church parade on a regular basis. I would do a church parade once every 6-7 weeks, which was normal for everyone. So the living out, the camp was away from the main body of Tidworth. It was out in the wilds, as it were. So we didn't have a garrison church, but the C of E canteen doubled up for one, for C of E's. I was OD at the time on the denomination, and Catholics got into the lorry and went down to Tidworth. As I say, there we were in clean fatigue. When we got to Tidworth, we had to stop because of all of the Scots were there and what have you, and all that regalia and what have you, and pipes going. And it wouldn't have disgraced the Horse Guards parade, but here we were in the back of a buggy on lorry and King Vicky waiting for them to go past so that we'd follow them into church. That sort of thing, you know. And by the way, it was sort of an unwritten law that if you were not on church parade, you're in bed on a Sunday morning. And of course, anyone that was on church parade, their faces were wrong because they were missing on their yoga exercises, as we call them, complete relaxation of mind and body. And if it was raining, or especially on a cold and snowy morning, you used to have to watch yourself if you were in bed. And it happened many, many times. Those that came back from church parade about 11:30, 12 o'clock, they were still in bed, by the way, they would decide who they would, and it was played on me as well, they would pin you in your bed whilst the rest got a hold of you, the bed, complete, and take it right outside, on the lawn outside, with about 4 inches of snow, and leave you there. And I do remember one occasion that I was one of the offenders, you know, I was doing it, when no less a personage than the RSM came along, and he smiled and walked away. Now, can you imagine such a thing happening, you know, even today? I mean, we would have been all being on each other. That's the sort of attitude. So, yes, I was quite able to spend an awful lot of time studying on this, and I didn't need it. The other point is this. I was talking about really high-class clothing that I was buying. On 4 and 3 a day, because I was getting my wife paid, on 4 and 3 a day, get off. Well, you know how money is, the value of money has changed. But 4 and 3 a day, if I was studying, I wasn't going to the pub each night. My outlay, perhaps, for a week would be tuppence. A cup of tea and my mum at the 10 o'clock tea break. Tuppence a day. And perhaps once a fortnight, once every 3 weeks, go to the pictures. The rest of my free time, I was out in the country. Oh, yes, I was trying to grasp the intricacies of the integral calculus and things that we were getting, that were being pushed at me on this course and what have you. Now, come 1938, the technical officer said, right, and he explained about where I was going. He said, and the point is this, I don't think we'd be able to allow you time off to go up to London and take your finals. However, he says, I'll write to them and probably do your finals here under examination conditions. And it was after I came back from that course at Chepstow that I did take that. And the results were, which were not official for the college, the results were that my mathematics, as against arithmetic, was a very good mark. The other subjects were general science, like physics, mechanics, and thermodynamics, statics, and all that sort of thing. General physics and science. I got a reasonable pass on that. Just scraped through the English. But that was good enough, and of course this put me in good stead for promotion. So why in heaven's name did I stay a private, as it were, a trooper, until well into the war? Well, you must remember that I was my upbringing, and I was also Bolshevik. And I wasn't, I wasn't averse to answering back to the RSM, no less. So, in their eyes, I didn't make NCO material. In the eyes of the technical officer, certainly, but not otherwise. That is the reason. And I think that probably clears things up for this course.
The course at Chepstow itself, what did it lead to? What was the thinking behind it?
Yes, I think before I said, now I've got the classifications wrong now. Yes, I think I said came out as a first class tradesman. That was quite wrong. I came out as a class A tradesman. I think I better just mention in the tanks those days, there was class B and class A tradesmen. Class B were of the men's service, i.e. I was a driver-operator. Had I taken the course, I would have become a driver-mechanic. There were B trades. The A trade was the boy service doing their apprenticeship and then coming in as a proper trade. Not because in the A trade, you have third, second, and first class, and what Chepstow was doing was trying to turn out third class. They weren't interested in anything other than third class. So went to Chepstow. Well, here again I found myself in our old First World War Army, because it had suddenly to expand, as indeed most barracks expanded when the militia came in. We were in these huts, and it was literally sleep, eat, and work. What did we learn? As far as I was concerned, it filled in the holes that were left in my general education of general knowledge, rather, of mechanical things, which was quite extensive. For instance, the first period was taken up with mechanical drawing and reading, which was a pure waste of time for me because I knew it all. From when? Remember back when I left school, I went to this door school. It was there. I learnt the end and side and elevation and plan and how to generate isometric drawings and all that. It was a cake. I was enthusiastic with it. And of course, when this was shown at me to begin with, I was sat at the back of the closet, as it were, imagining I'm yawning all the time. However, I had to go through it. Then, types of material, metallurgy. And incidentally, I learned there one little point which, many years ago, I think I put this on a tape earlier, that when I came, it took me, I had to look through the locomotive repair sheds in Gateshead, and I saw them there with the big connecting rods. What they'd done is with the memory pair, they cleaned it up, and it was in a bath of hot oil. And they were taking it out, and I would explain that when they took it out of the dryer and put chalk on it, something like that, to find these cracks that we can't see. And they brought this rot out, when I was told as a kid, it was a curio. Now it became a factor. And it incidentally told me why, and I never don't know why I never asked the question, because I was full of mechanical questions, but I never did ask the question, and that was all our vehicles, all our lorries. In those days, I would explain that the driving system, the driving wheel in front of you, and the driving column goes down to a gearbox, we call it. It's a worm and sector, of course, with a drop arm. And that arm goes, swings from the rear of the vehicle to the front of the vehicle like that. And on that arm, of course, is a lever which goes to the arms on the two front, on one of the front wheels and the other of the tractor arms. That arm, if it broke and you're going at speed, dreadful. So it was polished. The nail pin on it was absolutely polished, and then mineral jelly preservative. And every now and again, we found when it came back from the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, which was Remy in those days, that we'd have to do this again. Well, they were doing the same thing there. They were taking off, putting in the boiling oil to get it in, and then drying it completely off. And in the shop to see that the hairline cracks had developed. So that was anyway, materials that I was teaching. The other thing that I learned was I already knew that steel, if it had a low carbon content, it was called mild steel. You could work it, you could file it, you could do what you like with it, but you couldn't harden it. Yes, you could case harden it, but you couldn't harden it. If you had a higher carbon content steel, then it was, you were able to put it in the fire and get it to a red heat, depending on various degrees of redness, as we got hardness, and plunge it into water, and it would harden off really brittle. And then in such a state, of course, it ain't any good. The least hammer shock, and it would slither. And after that, you would put it in the furnace and bring it up so that it started, the metal from the silver would start going to various colours. And when it got to a certain blue, then you bring it out and quench it off, and you temper it. You can do that with carbon steel. However, if you get onto the carbide steel, certainly two tips in there. But coming back to this carbon steel business, that was my complete knowledge of playing with Chuck Stowe. When they started talking about steels that were self-hardening, or work hardening rather, molybdenum, we used to call it, and molybdenum, and I heard of it, a mixture of that chemical in the steel would give it this work hardening properties. And that's what our spanners were made of during the war. Thank goodness it was. Why? Can I tell you why, this day? Yes, why? Well, later on you'll find that I had experience not only with British tanks but also with American tanks. In fact, the battalion was equipped with a mixture at one time. And if you're an engineer at all, you'll know that all British vehicles in those days had the BSF or the Whitworth standard of nuts and bolts. Or remember the dimensions across the flats of the nuts and the bolt heads. But the American tanks were ASE, which were different. Now, the higher echelons, our betters up in the supply, who should have known better, but the downwell didn't. When these American tanks came, they came with the tools, beautiful set of tools, but of course the driver had. Euclid and Weefitters couldn't have, but they never gave us SAE spanners. English spanners wouldn't fit American spanners, never mind the main we had English spanners from these tanks. It's a bit of in the middle of the desert, how on earth, but our spanners were made of this bit steel was living, which means that as you worked with them, with the jaws of it hardened. So, if we got a good brand new file, fairly coarse, not too coarse, and put this spanner in the vise, and the face of where the nut fits, put the file on there and press hard and go. In other words, you break the surface, the hardened surface, and you get down to the soft, and then you can file away as if it was ordinary mild steel to whatever size you require. And so a BSF 516 spanner, we could file out to the next size up of the SAE. The other thing which I learned at Chepstow was that SAE spanner sizes, or nuts sizes, had a correlation with metric. I.e. that the distance across the flats of a nut head, a bolt head or a nut, in metric, or I think it was a DIN, DIN sizes, corresponded very closely to the SAE. So whenever we saw a German tank, we pinched their spanners, and therefore we have, Now, these sort of things may seem, well, not the greatest, very, very, very important when the battalion was relying upon that section, that section relying upon that tank, and that tank relying upon me having the proper size spanners, okay? You can't just go along to DIY and buy in the desert. So you see, why is an awful lot of this stuff, or should I put it this way, the chest store knowledge that I got was it could be put into two sections. Stuff that I already knew, and stuff which was interesting, but, do you use it in ordinary life? Well, yes, we did when we got into the desert. I'll just give you an example. So
it was a pretty high standard that you were doing there.
Now, the other thing here was there, whilst we did a bit of welding, which I never did as an ordinary battalion maintenance fitter, LAD did that. I learned how to weld, I learned how to turn, again, a thing I never did as a battalion fitter. Later on, I mean, learn how to cut threads and what have you, which of course is teaching you again thread profile, which came in handy later on, by the way. However, all this seemed to be well, okay, it's very nice, I'll make it, but is it any good to me? Well, yes, that wasn't, but the other part, well, I'll just mention. Practical things. We didn't have so much up here to do these, so obviously you could use your two hands. The other thing was they taught me how to chip with a cold chisel, i.e. supposing you've got a block of steel, which we'll say, just for argument's sake, it's 2 inches high, and you want it to be a 9.9, well, 3 or 4 thousandths of an inch off to fit in somewhere. In a machine shop, you just put on a planer or a grinding, a certain grinding machine. But in the desert, all you've got is a cold chisel and a hammer. For doing precision work, the dwarf is how to do precision work by chipping off carefully the thousand. And of course, when you finish, it happened to be a plowed field. It had to be, they put great emphasis on that, and it helped us. In fact, that was one of the passing out tests.
How long did the course last?
It would be about 6 to 7 months, but it would be, actually, we all used to say it's a year's course, but it was condensed. I mean, we didn't know church praise or anything, I was sat in this as well. It was necessary. Well, of course, war was coming on, and the cavalry was being mechanized. They were short. That was the other thing as well, by the way. There was other two chaps from my battalion went up with me, and there was other from other to the Italians. Of the three of us, I was the only one who went back to my own unit again. The others went to cavalry, which I was the hand of the technical officer was there as well, you see, but I didn't know this at the time, but I thought, oh, that's great. Not unreasonable. Well, to be frank with you, I was no different than anyone. We didn't like the cavalry. Donkey bash, as we call them. I now realise, of course, that they were just as good as we were. And in fact, they were probably better at their newfangled tin cans, as they call them, and probably better than we would have been if we'd been given horses. They put the horse's leg in the vice, didn't you? But there was an awful lot of animosity between them, so I was very, very glad that I came back to the tanks rather than the cavalry. The other thing, of course, as well, is that it's getting very close to the. It has happened. The 4th of April 1938, I suddenly ceased to be a private and became a trooper. That was when the RAC was brought in. And talk about putting the car before the horse, you'd have thought, well, okay, these people here who are horsemen, very good horsemen, they have to learn how to deal with tanks. Well, you'd have thought they'd say, well, right, you are, we'll absorb them into the tank corps. And the other way around, we were absorbed into the cavalry. That created an awful lot of, and it was quite unnecessary. And they said, hey, you can't have a corps within a corps, so you're going to be a regiment. That was the other infantry, you see. They'd been sort of been, in brackets, demoted, as it were, from the high mighty corps to a mere regiment. But
so what regiment did you find yourself in April when they changed it all over?
I then became trooper Cheeseman, Sunday away, Sunday, B squad, headquarters squadron, not company, of the 5th Battalion, exactly the same permanent side. That was.
But was RAC as against RTR, was it?
It was RTR. So I thought we said R.
RAC, RTR, where the.
We were. Our Royal Tank Corps.
Corps, RTC.
Royal Tank Regiment. When you said that was the Royal Armoured Corps, which of course.
Was the all embracing.
Yes. The cavalry and the.
So you've got. The squadron took over a new title, in effect, for company.
Yes, yes.
And then your troops for sections, was it?
That's right, sections to troops.
Troops. But the basic organisation remained the same,
exactly.
just the names, the titles changed.
The heading, as it were. Yes.
Did you get any cavalrymen in then, coming into your actual unit itself at this time, or just after?
No.
You still stayed the same?
Actually, it was of course, a stripping out of good men from the Royal Tank Regiment, of course, to the cavalry. To give them the tricks of the trade. If I might, just after I came back, that's right, and after Chamberlain came back with his paper, and getting back to normal, and we had to go down to Tigris. We were crowded, and then got me hammer and tongs on the way down, I was very proud of that. And we had to go down to the Queen's Own Regiment, who was one of the regiments stationed in Tigris, because Her Majesty, the Queen's mother, the day, Her Majesty then, was coming down to inspect, and they got their light tanks, Mark 6s. That was another thing, you see, they got all brand new stuff, and we still have all the old card and lives, you know, but they got the light tanks, and there was about 40% were movable, the rest were immovable. We had to go down and get them sorted out for them, you know. Well, fair enough, I mean, as I say, if we'd suddenly been had our tanks taken away and given horses, we'd be in the same place. But, you know, I was astonished at the things that we had to do, just little things, just to get the thing going. For instance, that one sticks in my mind. And that is the there was a lot of motorcycles, BSAVs, in mechanical regiments. And they got their motorcycles down there. And they were unrideable. On a motorcycle, it got a damper so that every little bit of shock doesn't come through your arms. A damper. And they screwed that right down so that you had to put force on to turn the handlebars. And they said, they were wheeling these bicycles out of there because they couldn't ride them. And I thought that was all that was required. But then, as I say, they were horsemen.
They had to learn that.
They had to learn that, you know. And of course, you can imagine that the tongue that we were.
But you were losing, and others, of course, were losing men who were directed to these queens and hussars and what have you to do this work for them and to train them to do it.
Well,